Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. In this episode, Lama Kathy Wesley teaches part one of a three-part series on Bokar Rinpoche's book, The Day of a Buddhist Practitioner. In this first episode, she details how, as Buddhist practitioners, we can grow beyond the habitual patterns of our mundane morning rituals and begin each day with a motivation that can bring us closer to true awakening. Enjoy the podcast.
The people who are at the welcome desk, to the people who set out the coffee and stuff and make sure it happens. Thank you, John. There he is now. Pay no attention to that man with the... Yeah, well... all I can say is I love being here. And the folks who are greeters and who take the people up to classes, the new folks up to classes, and who bring them back down so they don't get lost in the synagogue. This place is huge. And also thanks to all the meditation instructors who are on hand to teach them how to meditate and how to relate to meditation in daily life. And then to the folks who are here, the bookstore. Hi, Annie. I'm just saying hi. Are you downstairs too? Okay. let the record show for people who are listening to this and wondering what's happening. We have a pantomime artist who just made it appear as though he were going downstairs on a single floor. So I know the joke's not funny now that I've explained it, but anyway. So I just want to say thanks to everybody who, and the sound folks who have just continued to work to make our journey through the wilderness here at the KTC, to make our journey more comfortable and to help us to connect to the Dharma in ourselves and each other. And thanks to all of you for bringing your sincerity here today, because... The place is just a place, and you bring something to it that was not here before you walked in the door. And that is your sincere wish to be of benefit to both yourselves and to others, your sincere wish to understand and practice meditation and to help make this world a better place. So I'd like to begin with this moment of thank yous. Secondly, I'm going to start a series of talks today that will continue occasionally over the next few months. And this is actually a series of talks that's based on Bokar Rinpoche's book, The Day of a Buddhist Practitioner. This book is out of print, but you might be able to find copies of it online for outrageous sums of money. But in this book, he talks about how the practice of the Buddha's teachings is not something that you just do one or two days a week when you get together with your Sangha to chant or to meditate together, that the practice of Dharma is something you can do every single day. And it can start in the morning when you awaken, and can continue into the day when you work or interact with your family, and that it can then continue into the evening as you approach the end of the day. And so the practice of Dharma is something you can actually attempt to put into every facet and moment of your life. The great masters, because of the depths of their meditation, can mix meditation with every activity. They can have a mind that is very serenely placed and meditating when they bicycle to work, if enlightened beings bicycle to work, or cope with the boss or the family or whatever is going on in their lives. These great masters can be both in a state of meditation and interacting with others. The rest of us, it's a multi-step process. We first start with a lot of unawareness or a lack of awareness and running on habit energy through our day. We kind of run on our habit energy through the day. Whether it comes in a cup of coffee or it comes in some other form, We run on habit every single day, and it gets us through the day, but we are not often able to cultivate a sense of mindfulness and peace at the same time as we do our daily activities. And so at first, Dharma is something that we sort of mix in to our already somewhat confused daily activities. We start to mix Dharma in, and so that it becomes another sort of artificial activity that we mix in with our everyday life, and then slowly it begins to carry us through and have take on a life of its own through cultivating a type of dharmic awareness, a type of awareness based on the teachings of the Buddha. So that's what I'm going to talk about for these short talks based on the book, The Day of a Buddhist Practitioner. These will be sort of unannounced. I will try to put them in the calendar, and they'll be labeled The Day of a Buddhist Practitioner, part 1, 2, 3, and so forth. And this will also help the people who are doing the descriptions online. So haven't written them yet. You might need to send me an email later today to remind me I have to do that. Okay. I'm going to start, as I usually do, with a prayer. So if you are familiar with the four-line prayer of taking refuge, you can chant along. But if it's a prayer with which you are unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this period of time to the liberation of and the benefit of all sentient beings. O Sanje Chudan So Chi Cho Nam La Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Su Chi Da Ji Jin So Ji Be Su Nam Ki Dro La Pen Shir Sanje Dru Par Sho O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi Or Pede Ten Shula Kadrin Jimbo Gone Che Sun Te Kusun Tugi Ngutrup Sal Du So. Okay, thank you. Yeah, feel free to have a seat. Got a visitor in the back. Appreciate you coming and bringing yourself here today. Okay. When we wake up in the morning, I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I'm on automatic pilot from the moment I open my eyes until the moment I head off to work or to my first appointment of the day. In fact, I've even read about this phenomena. Psychologists have spoken about it. They actually do feel that people pretty much are habit-driven. They're sort of, that's how they get through their morning preparation. They just are on automatic pilot through this experience. And then they take it with them into their next assignment or their next appointment or whatever, this sort of mind of habit. It gets them through. It's the mind that eats breakfast without remembering that what one is eating, the one that drinks coffee without remembering that one has had coffee, and it's the one who washes and prepares without really having much of a sense of anything. So the first Buddhist practice then is for awakening in the morning. At first we apply what I would call possibly an artificial practice to awakening that takes the place of our other habitual awakenings. So in this particular practice, when one opens one's eyes and becomes aware that one has awakened from sleep, it is customary for a Buddhist to reflect momentarily on the preciousness of their human life, to feel a moment of relief that one is alive, to feel a moment of gratitude for being alive, and being able to wake up today and take that feeling of gratitude forward into your day, thinking, I'm glad. I'm glad that I am awake. I am glad that I am alive. And this life is very precious that I have. And then you take a moment to feel some gratitude for that. Also, there is a custom of thinking that one is hearing the sound of bells, and that there are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the sky around one, awakening one with the sound of a bell. And this is memorialized in a prayer that unfortunately we don't have in English, but we used in the three-year retreat. And it begins, Sheng Shik Pema Jungne Khandro Sum. So the idea is that awaken, basically it's asking us to awaken to the sound of enlightened beings. And so the idea is to not just awaken from the sleep of the night before, but also to make the aspiration that one will awaken into Buddhahood in the future. If not today... Perhaps that's too much to hope for first thing in the morning. But if not today, to make the aspiration that one will take steps toward awakening today, and that one feels the presence of and the accompaniment of the enlightened ones as one goes through one's day. Now, this may give you pause. I have received lots of... I'm going to talk on the side here, but I'll come back to the subject in just a moment. A lot of people have asked me, I thought Buddhism was a non-theistic religion, if such a thing can exist. Isn't the equal sign, you know, something, you know, theology equals religion and lack of theology equals not a religion, you know. So I don't quite know how to address that aspect of the question. But a lot of people say, well, If Buddhism is non-theistic, why think of the Buddha and enlightened beings at all? Why think of them at all? What's the point? Well, the point is that that we have the need as individual people for a goal and a purpose. People seem to do better when they have a goal and a purpose in life. They don't do so well when they have no goal and have no purpose. So you could say that the Buddha is both our goal and our purpose. The Buddha was an individual who lived 2,500 years ago who manifested an awakening of his mind. He actually meditated deeply and attained an understanding of his mind that was so total and so complete that when he arose from that meditation, he was changed. He was, you could say, endlessly compassionate and endlessly wise. And as such, he was, you could say, beyond ordinary. When people asked him, are you one of the Hindu deities? Are you a reincarnation of Brahma or Vishnu or any of the great Hindu gods? He said, no, I'm not. And they said, well, are you an ordinary person? And he said, I am an awakened person. So that put him in the middle between the two extremes of ordinary and divine. And so, what he did establish was this middle location, this middle path, this middle experience of being a person who is awakened, no longer ordinary, but not divine. And so then this causes us to ask the question, what is enlightenment? Is enlightenment a blank, trance-like state? You know, the spiritual equivalent of snow on your TV screen. Is that what enlightenment is? Or is it being in sort of a trance? Or is it being sort of non-involved and aloof from life? So we have to ask ourselves, what is enlightenment? The way the Buddha explained it was that it was a complete, purification of confusion. You could call it a complete elimination of confusion and a complete ripening of our basic goodness and qualities. In fact, the Tibetans, when they created the word for Buddha, they incorporated these two ideas. Sang, S-A-N-G, is the first syllable of the word Buddha in Tibetan. It means fully purified or cleansed. Jay, G-Y-E, the second syllable, means fully ripened. And so the Buddha is one who is both completely unconfused and purified of confusion and completely ripened with all of their inner qualities. And so what kind of confusion do we have? We have the confusion of thinking that our mind began when we were born and will end when we die. And we also have the confusion that our mind is very limited and small, and that this external world is all we will ever know, and that because we are small and vulnerable, we need to defend ourselves against everything and everybody, and that we somehow have to amass the largest number of people and objects in order to feel safe and worthy. Does any of this sound familiar? And so, as a result, our life is quite small and limited, because that's what we believe. That's the confusion. Whereas the Buddha said that upon his awakening, his enlightenment, he saw that the mind is actually incredibly vast and that it reaches everywhere, that the mind is incredibly vast and it is not made of a material substance. It's not made of atoms or molecules. It's not limited by materiality. And because it's not limited in any way, you can't say that that mind has a beginning or an end. You can't find it. If you were to look at your mind right now and say, where does it start and where does it end, you couldn't find it. So the mind is not established as a material thing, and yet it's not nothing, because it knows things and experiences things vividly. Whether it's awake or asleep, we're always experiencing something. And so these two characteristics, the mind's vastness, which is sometimes called limitlessness. Sometimes people use the word emptiness, but I think that confuses the matter a bit. There's a Tibetan teacher who lives in India. His name is Situ Rinpoche, S-I-T-U, Situ Rinpoche. And he says he doesn't like the word emptiness very much. He says, I know it's popular, but he said, I prefer the word limitless, that your mind is without limit. And that when you start describing your mind as having a color, a shape, a location, a beginning or end, that you're somehow limiting what mind is. And instead, he said, you can just experience your mind, and that will make the difference for you. So in any case, the mind is this empty and yet existing experience of itself, clarity. It experiences itself as knowing things and experiencing things, color, shape, and so forth. So it can experience anything, but it is not itself a thing. This sort of paradoxical description might seem a little weird, but that's what we are seeking to understand, first through philosophy. Buddhist philosophy talks about this, and second, through the practice of meditation. So what I always tell people is, if the word emptiness befuddles you, don't worry. You'll find out what it really means when you meditate. So then the enlightened being is a person who has understood mind's limitlessness and its clarity, and experienced mind's limitlessness and clarity in such a decisive way that one can never fall out of that wisdom. For most of us, what happens is we meditate for a little while, we feel a little bit of psychological relief, and then we go back to confusion as usual, believing in the solidity of self and other and all, everything else that goes with that, all the drama that goes with that. And so for us, meditation is a brief respite in a world of confusion. But it does encourage us that there is something more. And so this is why we think of enlightenment as not being static, but being dynamic. And because the mind has no beginning, it has no end. Therefore, the Buddha did not go out of existence when he passed from this world and still wishes to benefit us. And that every enlightened being who has ever lived, ever accomplished enlightenment, continues to exist and continues to wish us well and continues to serve as a beacon and as a guidepost for us as we seek to achieve the same state of awakening. So you could say that enlightenment you could say it's a verb and not necessarily just a noun. It could also be a verb. That enlightenment is something that we are undergoing slowly and gradually over a period of time. And so why we think of enlightenment when we awaken in the morning is so that we know what our goal is and we remember what our purpose is. We think of first this gratitude at being alive and the preciousness of our life, and then we think about the Buddha and the enlightened beings as being present with us and awakening us with those little imaginary bells. And so by thinking of their nearness, we don't feel alone. By thinking of their description, the bells, by thinking of the bells, we think of their activity in our life. We think of that as them being active in our life. And so as a result, the Buddhas are present and active. Then the next thing we can do is form our own motivation. That's the third practice we can do after we awaken. We haven't even gotten out of bed yet. So if you're the kind of person who, like folks in my family, like to awaken and then sort of take their time before they hop out of bed, you're in luck because this practice will be very good for you. Feeling gratitude, that's the first thing. The second thing is thinking of the presence of the Buddha and his inspiration. And the third is forming our motivation. Someone asked the Dalai Lama, there was a CNN reporter who went and interviewed the Dalai Lama. Can you imagine that assignment? That would just be amazing to go and interview the Dalai Lama as your job. Wow, how cool is that, right? So, but of course the person didn't really understand Buddhism, so they asked a lot of unusual questions. But one of them was very useful. They said, what's the first thing, Your Holiness, what's the first thing you think of in the morning? What's the first thing you think of in the morning? He says, in the morning, I set my motivation. I set my motivation for the day. And my motivation for the day is to benefit others. To benefit others. Because in that way, I reduce my self-fixation and I get closer to Buddhahood. Because that's really, if you remember the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, that's what the Buddha said. Suffering's part of life. Suffering has a cause. Suffering has a solution. And there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. The cause of suffering he described as being fixation and clinging. And what is the thing we cling to the most? We cling to our sense of me or I. And so as a result of clinging to this me or I, we tend to mistreat others. Yeah, I know. I think they're running through the hallways. That's what I always think of. They're actually the sanctuary is actually directly above us, and that's where the rumbling sound comes from. I don't know precisely what they're doing. Passover's coming soon, so maybe they're getting some things ready. So, or it's either that or they've let the kids go, right. Which sometimes when you get out of class, you run up and down the hallways too. So the Dalai Lama sets his motivation, and the motivation then is to be of benefit to others and to try to attain Buddhahood on their behalf. And so we might think that that's a bit of a high aspiration for so early in the morning to be a benefit to beings. That's a little hard to imagine before we've had our coffee. And also to attain Buddhahood. That's definitely going to be too tough to do before we have our coffee. But by repeating this motivation every single day, we have the potential to make slow and steady progress toward that motivation. Whereas if we don't make that aspiration, then we can be sure we will never arrive at that destination. When the Tibetans first came to the United States in the 1970s, when they taught us, they taught us with the example of taking a trip. They said, if you are living in Columbus, Ohio, and you want to go to New York City, you have to first think of going there. You first have to form the aspiration to go to New York City. Then you buy the bus ticket or the plane ticket or whatever, or rent the car, and you put together your provisions, pack your bags, and then make your plans and go. But if you make no plan, if you never have the idea to go to New York City, you'll never get there. And they say the same was true of enlightenment. If you never make the aspiration to go, then you will never arrive. So that's what we do. The first three things in the morning. Can anybody tell me what the first thing is? Gratitude. Okay, having gratitude for your human life. What's the second thing? Say? Sound of the bells and the presence of the Buddha. Remembering the presence of the Buddha and the sound of the bells of awakening. What's the third thing? Motivation. Setting your motivation. Okay, so you guys are here. Thank you. It's very cute. I can't remember. Oh, I was at our home monastery last week at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra, and for the first time I tried doing these pop quiz type questions with a small group of people who were learning a very complicated chant, and we had a blast. It was like being in grade school again, and they kind of liked it. So anyway, so I thought I would try it on and see if you guys got it, but you got it. So starting the day this way sets the tone for the whole rest of the day. Even if the whole rest of the day is swimming through your habits, you know, gotta go here, gotta do this, the gotta do, you know. But, you know, even if the rest of your day is like that, at least you have started off well. And if you persist and do it every day, then it's something that you then can rely upon as you go through your day. And if you are in possession of, I have about five more minutes here, so I'm going to add one more thing before I open up for questions. If you have the benefit of an image of the Buddha in your home, you can actually, after you get up and get out of bed, after you do those three things, I was just going to quiz you again, but I better just keep going. Okay, anyway, you know, you have these thoughts, and then you go, nah, think better of it. So if you have an image of the Buddha in your home, then once you awaken and splash water on your face or whatever, then you can come back to your room where there's this image of the Buddha, and you can formally relate to the Buddha. When I first took refuge, I wish I had a picture of it here. My teacher gave me a cardboard picture of the Buddha. And it had like a little stand on the back of it. It was a souvenir from some place. And it had this really fuzzy, grainy picture of a Buddha in a very ornate background. And on the back of it, it was something like, courtesy of the Buddhist Association of the United States. It was probably dated from the 60s or something. Anyway, so it was just this cardboard print of a Buddha picture. He said, here's your Buddha. And I'm like, okay. So I put that cardboard picture of a Buddha on an orange crate. I know it was the 70s. Anyhow, it was a decorating decision driven by financial issues. And so to make it nice, I put a pillowcase on top of the orange crate so that at least the picture would not fall down through the slats of the orange crate. Anyway, so, and then because my teacher had said that I should put offerings in front of the Buddha image, I did not at first have these really nifty bowls that they put offerings of flowers and incense and lamps and all of that. They didn't have all of that. So instead of doing anything else, I made those. I just put like a little stick of incense in front of the image of the Buddha, and so that was my offering, was to put that stick of incense in front of the Buddha. And then he said, after you make your offerings, you place your hands together at your forehead, throat, and heart, and make the aspiration, may I become a Buddha. May I offer my body, my speech, and my mind to the Buddha for the benefit of beings who suffer. And then I learned how to bow and all of that. And so by relating to this external image of the Buddha, this little piece of cardboard, that was my Buddha. Was this little piece of cardboard. It nonetheless helped me remember that I had the potential to be a Buddha. And that even though I couldn't quite totally believe that, my teacher had told me that I had the potential to become a Buddha and that he must know something, so I guess I better try this. And so that was my practice. And so this is the day of a Buddhist practitioner, part one. Starting your day with this gratitude to be alive, a recognition of your Buddha potential by imagining and thinking of the Buddha's presence and the hearing of bells of awakening. And the third is this setting of your motivation to be of benefit to beings. And then if you can, get out of bed and interact with your image of the Buddha, whatever it might be. Even if you don't have an image of the Buddha in your home, you can imagine one. And say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, his teaching, and I take refuge in the Sangha, my community. And by thinking this, you start your day with your body, the bow, your speech, the words, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and your mind making the aspiration. So I could go on and on, but that might not be interesting. But this is the part one of this multiple part series on the day of a Buddhist practitioner. And being able to bring the Buddha to mind often during the day is also a help to you. And so my teacher, knowing he knew my personality very well, and he said, whenever you feel fear or doubt, like I would have that, he said, whenever you feel fear or doubt, think of the Buddha and turn your mind toward the Buddha. And so that's what I would do. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I think that any of these practices, what they're really about is increasing our mindfulness so that we are not on autopilot and we're not increasing our habitual responses to things. Our knee-jerk responses to our feelings and our life, taking our life for granted, taking our Buddha potential for granted and not doing something with it. So the idea is by doing that, we can be of benefit to everyone we meet. Now, I know that aspiration of being of benefit to beings might seem a little steep. Like, how could I be of benefit to beings? Because I'm kind of confused. So here's how I say it. May everything I do today benefit beings in some way, and may we all become Buddhas. And the reason I say may it benefit beings in some way, it's because I have no idea. I have no clue what my impact on somebody else's life is going to be. I have no clue. So, not knowing, I could be a little anxious about that. So my aspiration is, even if I make a fool of myself, even if people see me and dislike me, may that be of benefit to them. So may it be of benefit in some way, even if I goof up, may that be of benefit. So anyhow, that's just a little helpful hint from one confused person who is still not a Buddha yet, which really stinks. Somebody said, you know, how does it feel to be a Buddhist teacher? I say, it's nerve-wracking. It's like you're on a tightrope. People look at you like you know something, and like you don't. And like your teacher asked you to teach, so that's why you're up here. And so it's like you're working without a net, and it's really kind of spooky. But at the same point, you did meditate a bit, so you might know one more thing than somebody else, so maybe that's why he asked you to do this. But it could just be that he's trying to get you to clean up your act. And so by being on display, you have to do it. Darn it! So who knows? But if I were enlightened, this would be way easier. So anyway, so that's a little bit about that. Let's have a discussion. We've got about like a little bit more than 15 minutes. So we do have a question microphone because we are recording today for people who couldn't be here. So if you don't mind going over to the mic to ask your question, that would be awesome. So questions, curiosities, you can just head over. Don't have to be called on. Just head over. And if not, we get to meditate. Ruh-roh. You can do it. You can do it. I'm counting on you, Arvin.
I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you. No pressure.
Of course not. What was I going to say? Just quick. Would just reciting the Tashi prayer every morning be just kind of a short and sweet, a shortcut to all that other stuff? If you just got to, boom, did the Tashi prayer. And then second question, because I have a lot of images and representations,
sure.
Or a fair amount.
Sure.
Not as much as some people.
Sure.
But is there one image that's maybe a little more auspicious than the others?
No, I understand.
If you had to have one.
Yeah. What would it be?
Maybe, right. You know, keep. I'm sure maybe your response, keep it simple, would be like just have the Buddha. But I don't know if there's one.
No, I get it. Yeah, I tell you what, I think... What I think about the first is that he's referring to something. I better define my terms. The Tashi prayer is sometimes called the prayer of the eight noble auspicious ones. And it refers to a prayer that was written in the 19th century in Tibet by a Tibetan teacher. And it consists of an excerpt of one of the Buddhist sutras. Frequently, a Buddhist will recite the actual words of the Buddha as an inspiration. As a way of inspiring themselves, they'll actually repeat the words of the Buddha. And this particular sutra was based on a question that a Buddhist disciple asked the Buddha, like, how do I bring auspiciousness and goodness into a situation? And the Buddha answered by reciting the names of all of the enlightened beings. Well, you can't recite them all. So he said there are eight Buddhas and eight Bodhisattvas. And so reciting the names of the eight Buddhas and eight Bodhisattvas is a way of bringing goodness into a situation. Because Buddhas are good. And so because Buddhas are good by nature, then saying their names evokes that goodness. And we can see this actually in the mundane world. If you think of the name of a person who is famous for being kind and wonderful, like Mother Teresa, you get a feeling when you say her name because you know who she is. And if you have a person who has done many negative things, the one that always comes to people's minds is Adolf Hitler, because he just caused such terrible things happening in the previous century. So you can see all the negativity that goes with that name. And this is just in the mundane world. So in the world of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, by reciting their names, this is a really beneficial thing. The prayer also goes on to say, by reciting your names, may goodness and flourish and all of that sort of thing, and may whatever I'm about to do be successful. But I'm thinking what's missing from it is this intention.
Gotcha.
I mean, is saying, I am going to recite this prayer for the reason of wanting to be of benefit to beings and to slowly bring myself and all beings to awakening. I think that motivational piece has got to be in there somewhere. Cool. Otherwise, it's just an empty recitation.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Then,
maybe there's something else that would be like a shortcut? Like,
yeah, it's I take refuge in the Buddha. Okay. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha.
Okay.
And the other one, if you want to, the four line refuge prayer that we just recited at the beginning, it says in English it goes like this: from now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Through the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives.
Right.
That would be your best shortcut.
Okay.
Because then you have the bodhisattva motivation, the motivation to benefit others, the taking refuge and thinking of the Buddha, and all of that.
Okay.
Gratitude for your life, and you're going to have to make sure you put that in there someplace. But
okay.
So, okay?
All right.
So that's your best shortcut.
Okay.
Next question is, if you only have the ability to have one image, what would it be? You know, I can't really say with certainty, but what I can do is quote something that Situ Rinpoche, that great lama that I talked about, he said that from his point of view, if you're a meditator, the best image to have is an image of the Buddha Shakyamuni sitting in what is called the earth witness posture, where his left hand is sitting in where it's just resting open face, with face up in his lap, and his right hand is touching the earth.
Right.
The middle finger of his right hand is touching the earth.
Gotcha.
And it's called the earth witness because it refers to an incident in the Buddha's life when he was asked, well, who proves? Who's the witness for your enlightenment? Mm-hmm. You're speaking like you're some kind of enlightened being. Well, like, who's the proof? Where's the proof of your enlightenment?
That was
who's your witness? And he said, the earth is my witness. Mm-hmm. And he touched the earth, and it shook.
That was after he took on Mara, right?
Yeah. That was after he became enlightened.
Right.
So what Sitra Rinpoche says is that because these images are drawn to specific mathematical proportions, each joint of the body is put to a pleasing mathematical proportion. So everything is in a pleasing and perfect proportion. And he's touching the earth, that's grounding, mm-hmm. and he has the hand in meditation in his lap. It's very grounding, so he says that image is the best image to have.
Okay, thank you.
It's even better if it's got relics inside it.
Okay.
Because then it's like really the presence of the Buddha in front of you, and making offerings in front of it and making aspirations in front of a relic mm-hmm. of the Buddha is like making them in front of the Buddha himself.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Any other questions? We have time for a couple more. And if there are no more questions, we meditate. Yes, please feel welcome. By the way, I'm happy everybody's here today. It's like, this is good. I missed you last week. Do you need the mic adjusted or are you good? Okay.
In the spirit of contemplating images to get you through the day, I often think of Milarepa, the ascetic, when I'm dealing with unpleasant things. I have some rather protracted unpleasant things I'm dealing with. They're not tragic. I mean, they could be much worse, but they're sort of chronic, and I don't feel like I should have to deal with them.
Right.
And so I remember him, like in tough times, you know, what mm-hmm. he went through to gain enlightenment for us.
That's right.
For the Kagyu mm-hmm. Lai in general, probably.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really very, very worthwhile, because if you remember the life of the great Tibetan Saint Milarepa, if you remember his life story, he had to deal with just unbelievable hardship in order to become an awakened being. And he did it, and he undertook all of those hardships because he knew that on the other side of that hardship was going to be awakening. You see what I'm saying? So the idea is that if we can look at our own hardships as purifying and completing some karma, then we can keep going to the other side. But yeah, Milarepa, you know what he said. He said, if I'm with whoever is thinking of me, I'm with them. So your thinking of Milarepa is just the right thing.
Well, there's a great image over here.
Is there, right.
Yeah.
The painting. It's the painting that's on the card, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Yes, please. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. You might need an adjustment there.
Can you go upstairs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. Now, yeah, she has to go upstairs. Can somebody help her with the mic stand? Thank you. All right.
Got it. Okay.
All right.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm always curious about the semantics of why does it say until the attainment of enlightenment? You keep doing these things after?
Yeah, I understand. And I think that it is a semantic. It is a semantic thing. In fact, you'll get a kick out of this. In my favorite book, have I told you about my favorite book? People are so sick of me recommending this book. In this great book, The Great Path of Awakening, which is written in the 19th century on a 12th century text, it actually explains that. It talks about that. He says here, basically, the wish to benefit others doesn't stop. It never ends.
Right.
It never ends. He said, but you have to start with the idea that you're going to do it until awakening so you don't quit beforehand.
I know.
And I mean, technically, that's the idea, is that unless you name a time, unless you actually speak that time, say, until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and so forth, unless you name that time, you might be tempted to quit when you are short of that goal. So that's why they say until enlightenment is reached, I'm going for it. Enlightenment or bust. You see my point? But here's what he says. Jamgon Kantrol, this great 19th century master, he's just really lovely. He talks about what's called bodhicitta, which is the mind of awakening, which is the mind that wants to attain awakening for the benefit of sentient beings and that is fueled by wisdom and compassion. Here's what he says. Even when full Buddhahood is attained, there is nothing to do except to work for the welfare of others with non-referential compassion.
So it gets easier.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. It gets easier because once you're awakened, you don't. That's why I'm joking around about being a teacher while not being enlightened. Teaching while not being enlightened, it should be like driving while under the influence. You know, it should be illegal. Teaching while not enlightened, you know, and it's tough from that point of view because we're just doing our best.
Yes. So rather than my mind tends to think, oh, until I attain enlightenment, so then I'm off the hook when I'm enlightened. You know, I
right.
can't stop then.
Well, and that's and I hear that. So then you have to say until and beyond.
There we go. Thank you.
If you need a couple extra words, you can just say until and beyond. Oh,
like
my gosh.
Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, Buzz Lightyear, infinity and beyond.
Thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, while we're talking Toy Story, people who know me know that I'm a total freak for Pixar movies and things like that. Toy Story was the first Pixar movie, of course, made. But it was the first one I saw after coming out of retreat. It had been out from some time, but I had been out of circulation for 3 years. You got to remember, I hadn't seen any movies for 3 years. Which reminds me, I was seeing a concert the other day, and this one singer was saying, oh, everybody's going to know this song, and he sang it. And I said, I bet that song came out between 1993 and 1996, because I had no idea what he was singing. Anything that it's like a black hole of pop culture, it's gone for me. It didn't happen. Anyway, but Toy Story, what I felt was when I saw it, I instantly recognized it as a parable about the pitfalls of jealousy and pride. And so to me, the whole thing was a Dharma movie. I'm like, oh, that's so wonderful. It's about, you know, enlightenment and everything. And you know, the lady who was sitting with me, she had rented it. I was at her house, you know, and she's like, what's this all about? And I'm like, oh, it's so beautiful. Anyway, so anyhow. Once you take the Bodhisattva vow, you see all this kind of stuff everywhere. So. Other questions? Curiosities? Well, then we'll sit quietly and dedicate the goodness of this session. So I hope everybody will go home this week and when they wake up tomorrow say, oh yeah, Lama said I should think of something. What was that first thing? Oh, I don't remember. I like the bell thing though. That sounded really cool. And the motivation, I can do that. But what's that first thing again? Oh, gratitude. You know, so anyhow, if you can just apply something this week. And then when we come back together again, I'm actually not teaching on this the next time. Because my next teaching is on April Fool's Day, I gotta go for an April Fool's theme. So it's about what it means to be foolish in Buddhism. Ah, who is a fool in Buddhism? So we're going to talk about that. And then after my next teaching after that will be the continuation of this discussion of the Day of a Buddhist Practitioner. So anyway, so we dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings be free of suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. So we'll sit quietly for just a moment. Okay. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, so everybody have a good week, and I'll be out next week, but there'll be another Dharma talk next week on Boko Rinpoche's book, Meditation Advice to Beginners. So have a great week. If you have questions that you couldn't ask for the group, you can come up and ask me now.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. For more information about the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music on this podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.